the period after the invasion, there were no militants, terrorists in Iraq. And that's what we knew then, that the reason for the war in 2003 was to supposedly get rid of weapons of mass destruction, which were not there and never found, of course, because they had already been dismantled. But ISIS and other militants flocked to Iraq in part to push back the United States coalition and to try to free Iraq from what they saw as a foreign occupation. And so the birth of ISIS is in part due to the U.S. invasion in 2003. And of course, ISIS spread in the region and took over large swaths of territory, which then had to be retaken. And it was a very intense fight. So the United States remains there to do that at, as you say, requested nearly $400 million for next year.
Professor Crawford, why did you include Syria in the costs of war with Iraq?
Well, quite simply because when ISIS took this territory, they didn't take it just in Syria, they took it in Iraq. The reason why President Obama said the United States needed to be in this fight was because the democracy that the United States hoped to set up and support in Iraq, the government there was at risk. Large parts of the territory near Syria were taken.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Evidence emerges that the coronavirus originated in animals.
And our public defender's office is calling upon the courts to force a withdrawal of attorneys.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 17th, 2023. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Reed Johnson. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, has issued arrest warrants for Russian President Vladimir Putin and Maria Lvova-Belova, his Children's Rights Commissioner. Lvova-Belova is the official at the center of an alleged scheme to forcibly deport thousands of Ukrainian children to Russia. This news comes just days after several U.S. news outlets reported that the court was planning to open two war crimes cases tied to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The outlets already suspected the ICC would issue arrest warrants against several people. The first case involves Russia's alleged abduction of Ukrainian children. The second concerns Russia's targeting of civilian infrastructure, including water supplies and gas tanks. The ICC statement today says there are reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Putin bears individual criminal responsibility for the aforementioned crimes by committing the acts directly or through others in his command, and for failing to exercise control properly over civilian and military subordinates. Russia has characterized reports of forcible relocation as absurd. It also said it does not recognize the court as having jurisdiction there. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked the ICC for its, quote, historic decision, saying in his nightly address today that Ukraine's investigations also suggest the Kremlin had direct involvement in the forced deportation of children into Russia. Zelensky said, quote, in the criminal proceedings being investigated by our law enforcement officers, more than 16,000 forced deportations of Ukrainian children by the occupier have already been recorded. But the real full number of deportees may be much higher. Such a criminal operation would have been impossible without the order from the highest leader of the terrorist state, end quote. The ICC is meant to be a court of last resort and is not meant to replace a country's own justice system. It has 18 judges serving 9-year terms, and it tries four types of crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, crimes of aggression, and war crimes. Because it does not conduct trials in absentia, Putin and his commissioner would either have to be handed over by Russia or arrested outside of the country.
Attorneys filed a court motion this week aiming to stop public defenders from being saddled with more clients than they say they can ethically and legally handle. They said excessive caseloads violate the constitutional right to effective legal counsel. The motion asks Marion County Circuit Court to withdraw public defenders from certain cases, to stop appointing a nonprofit defense firm's lawyers to new cases, and to dismiss the remaining charges for anyone left without a court-appointed counsel. The motion appears it's designed to get before the Oregon Supreme Court quickly. Oregon had previously operated a system deemed unconstitutional. That system also appeared to encourage attorneys to take on as many cases as possible. Now the problems are even worse. For more than a year, Oregon's public defense system has failed to provide attorneys for hundreds of people charged with crimes, including some people in custody. This week, more than 700 people were awaiting counsel, including approximately 80 who were locked up. Most of the people in custody without attorneys are in Multnomah, Klamath, and Washington counties.
The Public Defender's Office often serves marginalized communities, which are overrepresented in incarcerated populations, but which wield little political power to affect change in the state capital. The argument in the current case rests on ethical and legal standards established by the Oregon State Bar and U.S. Supreme Court. Those standards say defense attorneys must conduct constitutionally required investigations before advising their clients whether to go to trial or to accept a plea bargain. States have been required to pay the cost of defense attorneys for impoverished persons charged with crimes since the U.S. Supreme Court decision Gideon v. Wainwright was decided 60 years ago this week. The motion contends the public defender of Marion County has just 63% of the attorneys necessary to meet current caseloads. This amounts to a shortage of approximately 11 lawyers. Last year, an American Bar Association report found Oregon's public defense system had just 31% of the public defenders it needs, a shortage of nearly 1,300 lawyers. Oregon lawmakers are considering bills offering additional support for public defense. Many of the ideas lawmakers are considering are recycled from previously failed bills, such as making a portion of trial-level public defenders state employees.
The Senate is trying to officially end the Iraq and Persian Gulf wars. Advocates fear a ban on medications used in abortions, and red states are moving to further restrict mail-in voting. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks. Oregon lawmakers passed a multi-million dollar housing package which will help create new shelter beds for unhoused people. But existing shelters across the state are at risk of closing, and the new money isn't going to help. In fact, we may see a net loss of beds in some areas. Governor Tina Kotek issued executive orders in January to address the housing and homelessness crises in the state. The $200 million package passed by the State House this week allocates about $85 million to expand shelter capacity in the Portland area, Central Oregon, and Lane County, among other places. The money can only be used to create new shelter space. Shelters already operating don't qualify for the funds. Her office said in a statement that the executive order, quote, builds on existing shelter capacity, so it's critical that local communities maintain their existing investments, end quote. Rising costs and inflation have created a funding gap in housing. Salem has a lot of success with micro shelter villages, but now the city needs some $9.5 million to keep operating them. Eugene created shelter space for more than 250 people, but with federal funds drying up, those beds are at risk for closing. Bend is reporting a similar problem. The city needs hundreds of more shelter beds to meet demand. The annual tally of the area's unhoused population estimates that nearly 1,300 adults and children are experiencing homelessness in Central Oregon, a 17% increase compared to the year before, The legislature's $200 million housing funding package still needs approval from the democratically controlled Senate, where it's expected to pass. The legislature also still needs to approve a two-year budget, which could include additional dollars for city shelters. And now, 2023 talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
We owe it to our service members to fulfill our constitutional obligations and vote to end endless wars.
Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia says the repeal of decades-old authorizations for the use of military force in Iraq is long overdue. The Senate voted Thursday to advance legislation to repeal authorizations for the 1991 Persian Gulf War and the 2002 Iraq War. 19 Republicans supported the measure. Lawmakers say it's time to reclaim congressional powers over U.S. military actions. Vice President Kamala Harris met with public health advocates Thursday as they brace for a ruling from a federal judge in Texas which could limit access to abortion medication nationwide.
If politicians can start using the court to undo doctors' decisions, imagine where that could lead.
A conservative Christian group is seeking to reverse FDA approval of the drug mifepristone, which combined with another drug is the most common form of abortion in the U.S. Meanwhile, the governor of Utah has signed a bill effectively banning abortion clinics beginning next year. At least 80 bills in 23 states aim to restrict mail-in voting, making it harder to request a ballot or have it counted, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota says mail-in voting was secure both before and during the pandemic.
And the key is voters got used to it, they liked it, and attempts to roll this back and to make it harder to vote are the wrong way to go for our country.
Efforts to curb mail-in voting in GOP-led states are being fueled by unproven claims of widespread voter fraud. Senator Lindsey Graham has introduced legislation to codify two recent Supreme Court rulings, Bruin and Heller, protecting Americans' rights to own guns and use them outside the home for self-defense.
To conservatives, this is a wake-up call. We need you. Understand what's going on here.
Graham says President Biden's recent executive order on gun safety chips away at the Second Amendment. By codifying the rulings, the Supreme Court would have greater difficulty in altering or reversing them in the future. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says America's banking system remains solid following some of the nation's largest bank collapses in history.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them.
The Senate finance hearing grew tense when Yellen told lawmakers President Biden is willing to work with them on reforming Social Security. GOP Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana abruptly cut her off, declaring, "That's a lie." I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A birthing center helping the underserved Multnomah County may close. This could have profound consequences for a number of local Oregon communities. Eric Tagadoff has more in the story.
Nurses are concerned about the closure of a Portland-area birth center scheduled to go through today. The Family Birth Center at Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center is closing because the hospital says it maintains a low volume of births with an unusually high-cost care model. Nurses at Legacy Mount Hood are in the process of unionizing. Registered nurse Alejandrina Felipe works in the center and says it provided a valuable 24-hour service to an underserved area east of Portland.
Any emergencies or patient has a headache, they're worried for high blood pressure, they don't feel that baby moves, the first thing their OB provider tells them is go to the nearest emergency department and they come to Mount Hood because we're here.
Felipe says nurses were offered the chance for a job in another part of the hospital, but she is taking severance. The center delivered more than 750 babies a year. The Oregon Health Authority hasn't yet approved the closure and said in a statement this week that the hospital could be subject to regulatory action if the center closes its doors. Felipe says the birth center's closure leaves a gap for a diverse group of patients.
More than 50% of our patients are Latinos, Russian, Middle Eastern, or a lot of the Asian Pacific Islander APIs.
Felipe says nurses want to unionize because they feel management at Legacy was making decisions without input from them.
We're working towards becoming a union. If we were a union, we would not be going through this.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Legislators are trying to address skyrocketing housing costs in Washington state. For more on the story, we once again turn to Eric Tegedoff.
Affordable housing is a major concern in Washington state, and lawmakers in Olympia are considering a slate of measures to address it. One option is around funding for the Housing and Essential Needs Program, which provides rental assistance for low-income Washingtonians with temporary or permanent disabilities that keep them from working. Michelle Thomas with the Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance says Governor Jay Inslee proposed increasing the program's funding by $15 million in his budget, but that would still result in an $11 million decrease this funding cycle.
Because the program, even with this extra COVID dollars over the last 2 years, has still not been able to meet the need, we will feel this in our communities. It will feel like a cut, and less people will be served at a time where rents are so high that people desperately need rental assistance.
Thomas stresses that the Housing and Essential Needs Program is not an entitlement, and so when funds run out, access to the program does as well. She also notes rental assistance through this program ends when people qualify for Social Security benefits, which Thomas says isn't enough to keep up with today's rent. House Bill 1260 would change that. Thomas says real estate activity funds homelessness services, but is down dramatically. She says House and Senate lawmakers should keep this in mind as they craft their budgets.
If the state doesn't take action to backfill that document recording fee shortfall out of the general fund state operating budget, every community across the state will see cuts this year to homeless services.
Thomas adds keeping people in their homes is a big component of homelessness services. She says the legislature needs to take housing pressure off everyone.
All communities are being impacted by these high rent increases, and in the end, it costs the state a lot of money. If the state wants to try to continue to keep the level of funding consistent with homeless services.
The session is scheduled to end on April 23rd. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegeda.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Civic Cipher. At 8, it's Youth Pandemonium. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with skies clearing later on. The low will be 38. Tomorrow's weather will show sunshine in the morning, with cloudy skies in the afternoon. The high will be 66 degrees. Today in history, in 1969, Golda Meir becomes the first female prime minister of Israel. The quote of the day is from the prime minister, who was known as the Iron Lady of Israeli politics. Meir said, "One cannot and must not try to erase the past merely because it does not fit the present."
An international team of viral experts announced yesterday they had found genetic data linking the coronavirus with raccoon dogs for sale at a market in Wuhan, China. This supports the case that the pandemic might have been started by an infected animal involved in the illegal wildlife trade. The genetic data were drawn from swabs taken from a wholesale seafood market starting in January 2020. Chinese authorities had already shut down the market because of suspicions that it was linked to the outbreak of the new virus. The animals had been cleared out, but researchers swabbed floors, walls, metal cages, and transport carts. The research team found genetic material belonging to animals, including large amounts that were a match for the raccoon dog in samples that carried the coronavirus. This does not prove that a raccoon dog was itself infected, nor does it prove, if a raccoon dog had been infected, that the animal spread the virus to humans. The debate about what caused the coronavirus pandemic has reemerged recently. Republicans in Congress appear to be pushing the theory that a laboratory leak was to blame. The lab leak theory has gained traction thanks to a new intelligence assessment heard during hearings led by the new Republican House leadership. Chinese scientists had already released a study looking at the same market samples. It reported that samples were positive for the coronavirus, but suggested that the virus had come from the infected people already in the market rather than from animals being sold there. An international research team started looking at new genetic data last week. They noted some came from a specific stall that contained caged raccoon dogs on top of a separate cage holding birds. This is exactly the type of environment conducive to the transmission of new viruses. The international team reached out to the Chinese researchers soon after the genetic sequence data disappeared from its online repository. It's not clear who removed them or why they were taken down. The research team is now seeking more data, including some from market samples that were never made public.
Texas just announced a state takeover of Houston's public school district. With nearly 200,000 students, it's the eighth largest district in the country. This is one of the largest school takeovers ever in the United States, and it takes place in Texas's largest city. The takeover appears to be an example of Republican and mostly white state officials attempting to take control of actions in heavily minority and Democratic-led cities. Schools in other big cities, including Philadelphia, New Orleans, and Detroit, have also undergone state takeovers. The Texas Education Agency plans to replace Superintendent Millard House II and the district's elected Board of Trustees. Education Commissioner Mike Morath said the board has failed to improve student outcomes, has conducted chaotic board meetings, and has violated Open Meetings Act and procurement laws. He specifically accused the district of failing to provide proper special education services and of violating state and federal laws regarding students with disabilities. He cited the poor academic performances at some 50 district high schools. But some feel race is a significant issue here because the overwhelming majority of students in Houston schools are Hispanic or Black.
The Texas State Teachers Association and the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas condemned the takeover. State Democratic leaders blame poor funding for the underperformances and called upon the legislature to increase monies for education and to raise teacher pay. An annual Census Bureau survey of public school funding showed Texas spent $10,342 per pupil in 2020, more than $3,000 fewer than the national average. The state was able to take over the district under a change in state law proposed in 2015. The district sued to block a takeover, but new education laws passed by the GOP-controlled state legislature and a January ruling from the Texas Supreme Court paved the way for the state to seize control. State takeovers are generally viewed as last resorts for underperforming schools and are often met with community backlash. Critics say they do not often lead to big improvements.
National Poison Prevention Week begins tomorrow. Experts are trying to raise awareness of the dangers of common household chemicals. Mark Richardson has more on the story.
National Poison Prevention Week is coming up, and the staff at the Illinois Poison Center is getting the word out to be aware of toxic substances around the house. The nonprofit organization provides both assistance and education for what to do if you suspect poisoning and courses on identifying poisonous substances. Last year, the center handled nearly 70,000 cases involving potentially harmful substances, ranging from minor to severe. The center's medical director, Dr. Michael Wall, says almost 40% of those cases involve children age 5 or younger.
This is kind of the hallmark week for us to get the word out of the importance of poison prevention planning in the house, in the home, to prevent those unintentional ingestions or exposures to potentially harmful products.
Wall says the Illinois Center was one of the first of its kind in the nation and has been a resource for almost 70 years. It's staffed 24 hours, 7 days a week, every day of the year, and can be reached at 800-222-1222. Wall says the center deals with many substances, including drug overdoses, medication errors or reactions, plants, household chemicals, automotive products, insect stings and bites, lead, carbon monoxide, and more. But he adds the most dangerous time for children can be a visit from a grandparent.
We recommend keeping the medications in their original containers and childproof caps, but grandparents will often keep their medications in pill minders. Those are not in child-resistant caps, and it is not uncommon that kids will get into them.
The center provides helpful information and guides, including stickers and refrigerator magnets with its toll-free number at no charge. But Wall adds, for those who need immediate help, there are experts standing by.
Our line is staffed by nurses and pharmacists, so it is medical professionals. They're not volunteers, and they are specially trained in medical toxicology to really answer and help with recommendations on a wide variety of potentially harmful exposures.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
An oil spill following a train wreck near a Washington State reservation is raising significant concerns. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tribal leader in Washington state is raising concerns about oil spills after a train derailment along a bay on the Swinomish Reservation this week. Crews on Thursday were cleaning up oil on land from the BNSF train. The Washington Department of Ecology first reported about 5,000 gallons of diesel leaked. Federal officials estimate around 2,500. Chairman Tom Wooten of the nearby Samish Nation released a statement saying safety is a priority and thankfully no one was injured. But Wooten says the spill signals a larger infrastructure issue, adding there needs to be a priority on evaluating infrastructure hauling hazardous materials. He says there also needs to be a weaning away from fossil fuels for preservation of native lands. In a statement to Como News, Swinomish Chairman Steve Edwards said he was grateful to first responders and various agencies working on the spill. Edwards says they'll continue to do everything they can to protect the waters and natural resources and ensure public safety. The Swinomish Nation has sued the BNSF Railway in the past over oil train shipments. The derailment is currently under investigation. Federal officials will spend $25 million to restore and conserve bison herds on tribal lands. The Mountain West News Bureau's Will Walkie has more.
Tens of millions of bison once roamed North America, but the species was hunted to near extinction in the late 1800s. Today, wild bison number in the tens of thousands nationwide, including about 20,000 managed by tribes. Jason Baldus works for the National Wildlife Federation and lives on the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. He says this recent announcement is a step in the right direction.
They're keystone species, so that should be reason enough to restore them to the landscape because it benefits the grasses, the birds, the insects.
He says herds also provide food and maintain the cultural identity of tribes. The money comes from the Inflation Reduction Act and will go towards building new herds and transferring more bison from federal to tribal lands. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland says officials also need to tap into indigenous knowledge more to keep preserving one of the most iconic animals in the American West. For National Native News, I'm Will Walkie in Laramie.
A new book explores the legal history of the Oneida Nation's fight to protect its sovereignty. Lena Tran of Station WUWM reports.
For years, the Oneida Nation faced challenges to its sovereignty from Hobart, a village on the eastern half of the reservation just outside Green Bay, Wisconsin. Disputes range from garbage collection to police jurisdiction and roads.
And they constantly and regularly try to tell the Oneida Nation how it should be going about doing its business.
Rebecca Webster is an Oneida citizen who served on the tribe's legal team. Now she's an assistant professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Webster shares the history of these legal battles in her book, In Defense of Sovereignty. The biggest clash involved Hobart's attempt to force the tribe to obtain permits for its Big Apple Fest.
Hobart's main arguments throughout all of this litigation is they're really challenging that the Oneida Nation isn't a legitimate government.
Ultimately, the tribe prevailed when a federal appeals court ruled in its favor in July 2020. Webster says Hobart's tactics were part of a wider effort to upend tribal sovereignty from the anti-Indigenous group Citizens for Equal Rights Alliance.
This isn't just happening here in Oneida. This is happening in other places. We need to continue that network of tribes talking to each other because we know this is something that we need to stay on top of and we need to stay vigilant.
Webster hopes her book sheds light on the issue for other tribes. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Volunteers are monitoring more than 1,000 species of plants and flowers through a program called Nature's Notebook. This helps people feel more connected to the environment. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As global temperatures warm, many plants flower earlier in the spring, and lots of animals are changing their migration or nesting schedules. It's impossible for professional scientists to be on the ground everywhere tracking all the changes. So trained volunteers are helping monitor more than 1,000 species through a program called Nature's Notebook. Alyssa Rose-Martin is with the USA National Phenology Network, which runs the program.
Folks go out in their backyards or parks or neighborhoods and answer a series of yes-no questions. Do you see leaves? Do you see flowers? Do you see individual warblers today?
For example, volunteers are tracking the bloom times of pollinator plants, such as milkweed, buttonbush, and coneflower, to help researchers study the risk of gaps in nectar supply for bees and butterflies. So people's observations are helping scientists better understand the effects of climate change. And Rose Martin says the work can be personally fulfilling, helping people feel more attuned to nature and its changes.
It just was transformative for them to see their backyard in a new way or notice things that they hadn't noticed. So I think there's something really powerful in just the act of observing.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 17th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's broadcast is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Eric Tagenoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, and the esteemed Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ashley Mackey. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.